Hi, and welcome to the Sunday Lunch Project Manager podcast for Sunday, the 27th of November, 2022. This week, I've got Jude Jennison on the show, the equine leadership guru. Enjoy. So, what's been going on with me? I think since the last time I spoke, I managed to sort out a certification in cloud with Amazon Web Services, which I've been planning to do for absolutely ages and never got around to doing it for one reason or another. But I managed to, with a bit of effort and good focus on the training on it, I managed to get through that by... it's all right. It's really good. Really pleased with that. So chuffed about. So I'm a certified cloud practitioner now, which is fab. It's always good to keep abreast of the technologies as in project management, I think, in the area that you're at, just to understand, to keep me grounded, I suppose, in technology, although I do play with stuff anyway. I've had a few challenges with my recording of podcasts in the last couple of weeks, where... probably boring people a little bit, but using a certain tool to allow me to use my green screen and have a background, I'm getting a lot of laggy videos. You'll see it if you see the video on YouTube, which is rather frustrating, and not solved it, to be honest. So that's meant I've had to resort to tidying up my office, and I'm going to be using my office as a background, so it's going to look a little bit scruffier than the background that I had, and less branded and things like that. So that's how it goes, I suppose. What else has been going? Yeah, so I've got a few interviews sorted, set up, that I've had to put off, and I have to reschedule. But I'll get them all sorted for in the new year, probably. Get that out there. Obviously, and happy Thanksgiving to my American listeners. Over the past few days, it's Sunday now, I think it was Thursday, so hope you all had a great time, and I hope everyone's enjoying Black Friday and Cyber Monday. I think that's it really today, just to give you those little tweaks of updates. Not a lot going on, busy at work, busy with family, bracing myself for Christmas. Another week and I'll probably be getting into the swing of it. But yeah, okay, so I'm going to shut up and let you listen to this fascinating conversation with Jude. I'll speak to you soon. Bye. Today, I'm really pleased to welcome Jude Jennison to the show. Jude is an executive team coach, author, speaker, specializing in leading disruptive change. A business owner since 2010, Jude previously worked for IBM for 17 years, where she managed budgets of $1 billion and led UK, European, and global teams. Jude develops leaders, executive teams, and entrepreneurs to accelerate their business results through greater clarity, connection, and commitment. She uncovers clients' default patterns of behavior by working with a herd of horses who respond to your nonverbal communications. Frequently described as courageous and inspirational, she overcame her fear of horses and transformed that fear into her business working with horses to develop leaders and teams. Jude, thank you for coming on the show and welcome.
Thanks, Nigel.
Obviously, this is going to be a fascinating conversation. Do you want to just tell the listeners a little bit more about you and kind of a little bit more where you are and things like that?
Yeah, so I'm based in, currently based in Warwickshire, UK, about to move to Staffordshire. I spent the early part of my career, the first 17 years working for IBM, and did a whole range of leadership roles, really specialising in not very much, not knowing anything, and very quickly realised that if I didn't want to go down a technical path, then I needed to be able to either manage clients or manage teams of people to do the stuff that I couldn't do.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we call leadership now, but in those days it was called management. And so I think I had about 17 jobs in 17 years and about as many managers. But really, wow, every single job I had had no job description, and it was more a case of, here's something over here that needs something doing, but we don't know what it needs doing. And so always about leading through uncertainty and leading change. And for me, one of the benefits about leading through uncertainty and leading change is, if it's never been done before, you can't really fail. because if it's never been done before, then nobody knows how to do it.
No, and that's
so true. So I became really adept at being able to look at something and see if there was a way through it and out the other side, and then to build a team, and so to have a vision, to build a team, and then work with the team and lead the team to execute that vision. And largely because I wasn't technical, I didn't have the technical capabilities, so I had to lead other people to do the things that I couldn't do. And that's really how I developed my career over 17 years. I then trained as a coach, and I coached people in IBM alongside my day job for a number of years, until I left in 2010 to set up my own leadership and coaching business. And at the time I was terrified of horses, and I thought, I'll overcome my fear of horses and that will be it. And in the process, I learned so much about my leadership that I trained in the work that I now do, which has many names, but I call it equine facilitated leadership, which is one of its formal names, which is a way of working with horses on the ground. So there's no riding involved, but it involves working alongside horses on the ground to get them to engage, to come with you through free will. So without being coerced, without being forced, looking at how do you build rapport, how do you build the relationship based on trust and respect, and invite them to come with you to achieve whatever you decide you want to achieve. Which of course is what project managers do all of the time.
Yeah. It's funny. I read a brief bit in a post on LinkedIn this evening, and I saw it said something along the lines of the fact that most project managers, you have no, authority. You just have influence. Yes. There are some situations where you have organizations set up where you get the team and you manage the team and you own the whole team. But actually, most PMs are in that situation. There's kind of matrix organizations, and we're trying to persuade people to come along with the vision that you've been given by a sponsor to make it real. And yeah. I can see the correlation.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, never more than today has that been relevant, because if you look at what's happening with the volume of people who are leaving their jobs, you know, every company I'm working with at the moment, their biggest issue is employee turnover and retaining the staff that they've got, and therefore having to recruit because they've got high turnover. And that's because people have felt that they haven't had free will, they haven't had a choice. And now they are choosing to leave their organizations because the working conditions don't work for them. And I think, as you say, project managers have been persuading people to come with them without authority for decades. And when you work with a horse, you really get a sense of there absolutely is total free will from the horse. You can't make an 800 kilogram horse do anything it doesn't want to do.
No, I can understand that. And I suppose it's that old story of the carrot and the stick scenario, isn't it? Is that it does, in real terms, with a horse, if you're trying to force it through sheer willpower, you're always at some point in danger, physical danger, aren't you? They will wait for the opportunity for that backlash.
Yeah, and you see some horrendous videos and things on social media where horses have kicked out at people, and you think, wow, what has led to that situation? And actually, if you think again in the workplace where people lash out, it's never over one thing. It's over a combination of many, many situations where suddenly people go, I've had enough, that I'm done. I'm either leaving or I'm going to completely rant and rave at you. And And it's the same with horses. It's exactly the same, but they're less polite than people. So I think what happens with people in the workplace is they, to a point, they will put up and shut up, or they'll argue, but then still put up and shut up. Whereas the horses are either engaging or they're not. And it's very clear when they're not.
Yeah.
Because they plant their feet, close their eyes, or they'll headbutt you. But either way, they won't engage if they don't want to.
Yeah, I can get that. And it kind of, it makes you think about the sort of, a lot of the education that you see about sort of micro activities that people do. And as you say, it's a boss can, a good boss or a bad boss can either lift you up or wear you down through all the minor things they do. It's not about the big things they do. Typically, whilst you do get that, that's the kind of thing that would make press, would make news, would make tribunals and things like that. But the micro activities are the ones that make people go, sod that, I've had enough now, I'm going.
Yeah.
But they won't do, they wouldn't have done anything, may not have even mentioned anything before that, and just step away from it. And that's the thing, isn't it? It's lots of questions popping in my head here. I'm thinking with two things that probably affecting that market is obviously the pandemic has made a lot of us reevaluate and think about what work life means to us. The change back from the remote with people who were fortunate, unfortunate, however you want to just think of it, to continue working during the pandemic, I've got into a situation where they've potentially found I'm one of these. I like working at home. I'm quite comfortable with it. I like people. I like working with people, but I can actually operate from home comfortably as well. Mm-hmm. But some people are being persuaded, or indeed, what's the word? What's it? Oh, I've forgotten it now. I don't know. But certain members of the government writing their notes and leaving them on people's desks to suggest that they come in. That's that kind of thing is going to make people go, actually, do I really want to be doing that? Do I want to be traveling? Do I want to be there? And changing it. And the other thing I think is, and I wonder if you agree with it, and what you've seen is, from a generational point of view, the me coming from in the 80s when I started working, it's kind of expected, it was the default to go to an office. Some of the younger generation coming into there now, it's partly because going into the office was the only way to do it.
Yeah.
Now, even before the pandemic, the tooling was there to go, do we really need to be there? The mindset wasn't, but the tooling was pretty much there, and it needed some tweaking. But now and you think about it, you've got, I know nephews and nieces of mine who would have sat there watching a movie with their boyfriend and girlfriend on FaceTime. And they're sitting there with the two of them. One's at home, one home, one at the other, watching the TV together. And it's kind of like, I just sat there thinking, I couldn't imagine doing that, but that's because that wasn't available to me. And I think that when you think about what we're doing now with hybrid working, it's the same thing, but it comes naturally to the latest generation that are moving into the workplace. And so they're more likely to question, why do I need to be there when I can be anywhere and be nomadic or be just based at home or whatever?
Absolutely. And I think, I think there's a real tension here, and I think it's going to go on for some time around what works, what actually works in terms of hybrid working, remote working. Who needs to be in the office? When do you need to be in the office? How do you collaborate? I was talking to one client recently, and he said, actually, when we're working on an Excel spreadsheet, it's easier to collaborate online than it is to do it face-to-face, because online you can share your spreadsheet and you can do it on Google Sheets and you can all be updating it at the same time.
Yeah.
So there are some things. And so I think there's a tendency to think that collaboration is better face-to-face, whereas sometimes collaboration is better remotely. And I think it's about thinking smartly around what works individually, collectively, and organizationally. And I think that's really complex. And I think we're a long way off working that out yet, because it's so personal. I mean, I led European and global teams years ago, you know, over 15, 20 years ago. And the only technology was the phone.
Yeah.
So we had this laborious teleconference calls because the video technology, you know, it existed, but it was really in its infancy and it was diabolical.
Yeah. You had to book the room in 2 weeks in advance, didn't you? And there was a special, quite often it would be some very senior member of an organization whose PA would own the key because they didn't want everyone using that 20 grand's worth of kit there in case it got broken. And as you said, nine times out of 10, you'd go in there, and whilst it worked, when it didn't work, you ended up having a conference call, didn't you, between the two people sat in video conference centers in two different buildings.
Yeah, and the time lag was so terrible, it was really hard to have a conversation. So it's, you know, it's very different. But I think my experience of working via teleconferences was you could build relationships, but you had to work much harder.
Yeah.
And I think the same is true with Zoom calls and Teams or whatever the technology is that you use with video conferencing today. You can build relationships and you can collaborate. But you actually, when you meet somebody physically face to face, you feel their energy and you feel them in a 3D form. And they're often taller or shorter and thinner or fatter, or they feel different when you meet somebody face to face. And so I think there is no substitute for the face to face. And also there's no substitute for the walking past somebody's desk and overhearing something and then thinking, oh, I can add to that.
Yeah.
Whereas when we collaborate online, we have to do it much more consciously and we have to plan it. The other thing that I'm finding at the moment with teams that I'm working with is that where working has been purely remotely for the last couple of years, some of the minor disagreements have become major disagreements. Mm-hmm. So if you imagine you go into a meeting physically and you know, a couple of years ago you were physically face to face in a meeting, and let's say you had a minor disagreement with somebody and that person just left feeling a little bit sore. If you were in the office, you could wander past their desk later on and say, oh, Nigel, I'm sorry about that earlier. Are you okay with that? And you go, yeah, Jude, no problem. That's absolutely fine. And that would be it. It would be done.
Yeah.
Whereas when you have a minor disagreement on Zoom and then you drop off, then you fester. And in order to resolve it, you need to either pick up the phone, which is much more formal than walking past somebody's desk, or you have to plan a Zoom call, which is even more formal, and therefore people don't. And so some of these minor disagreements have been ignored and brushed under the carpet, and then they build and build. Until then, suddenly you find that you think that you disagree on everything, whereas actually you had one small point that you started disagreeing on, and then it blows out of proportion based on assumptions that are all just made up.
And there's a lot of
that going on in teams at the moment, where they have lost that social connection and they've lost that emotional connection. So whilst they're working very collaboratively and cognitively, some of the emotional connection has either not got created or has been lost to a certain extent. And I think we are re-establishing that. And pretty much all the teams that are walking through my gate at the moment, so somebody only a couple of weeks ago said to me, I need to learn how to be in the space of other people again, because I'd forgotten what it was like to really listen.
Course.
And because online we tend to try and do things quicker and then get it over and done with. And yes, that might seem like it's more productive, but we've lost that social skill, the wrap around it. The sitting having a cup of coffee while everybody's gradually piling into the meeting room, as opposed to on Zoom, where it's somehow just a bit more awkward as everybody's joining at different times. So I think there's still a lot of social skills that we need to re-establish and relearn and learn in a different way. And I think we've got some, I think it'll be a long while before we actually get there.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, because a number of things there. Sort of, the first ones that pops up to me is that the disagreements and the misunderstandings over the virtual world. I've over the past, I'm trying to think, probably, yeah, it'd be just over 2 years ago on a piece of work I was on. I had that same situation where, and it was possibly me, possibly both parties let something build, and it did build to quite ahead actually. And I took a lot of grief from, I personally took a lot of umbrage and put me through a lot of stress. Mm. And it was, again, I think if we'd been in the room, it would have been a conversation as we were walking out the room or later at the coffee machine going,
exactly,
hang on a minute, that's not right, I don't like that. We could have gone down the coffee, gone for a walk, whatever. And you couldn't, yeah, you didn't, it was, it didn't happen. It could have happened. And I think I was probably less receptive than I should have been. But I think it was heightened. The situation was heightened anyway. There's a number of different reasons, not just because of COVID, but because of, it was during the beginning, right at the beginning. So it was, there's a number of other things that caused it as well. But I really echoes with me there. And the other thing on that was, and I'm sure I've said this on the show before, there's I don't know where I heard it many years ago. There was a thing about communication and the phrase, I never said she stole the milk. And that as a text item is, to most people listening would go, well, it's obvious what that means. And I did an exercise the other day with my team, and I wrote that down. I had modified it a little bit for, so it's very specific to them. And if you emphasize each word in that sentence, like, I never said she stole the milk, suggests someone else said she stole the milk. I never said she stole the milk, suggests she took it, she didn't steal it. I never said she stole it. You emphasize each of those. And the thing is Zoom calls have become phone calls, or IM as well, instant messaging being picked up. And that, and I did go through this with my daughter when she first had her first mobile phone and started texting with friends, to kind of go, what they've written there and what you're speaking in your head is completely different, potentially. Mm-hmm. Might be the same. And learning to stop and think, because those kind of conversations, you can get on, it's like, what, that's why Twitter is the biggest fight club in the world, because you've got a very short number of words to write there, very little emotion that you can put an emphasis in there, and people misread what you mean, and then you misread what they misread, and just, you can just go crazy. And I think
then we emotionally disconnect because, yep, it's uncomfortable. Yep. And we don't like the uncertainty of a relationship that's just not solid.
Yeah.
And so it's easier often to disconnect, and particularly in the online space, it's easier to do that.
Yeah.
Because we don't have the same social connection and the same emotional connection, and this is why people are leaving their jobs, because they haven't got that social and emotional connection to keep them to want to stay.
Yeah, and which means that you, as an organization, you've got to think more about how you create that inclusiveness, create that sense of well-being. Mm-hmm. But also, but again, you've got to do that without alienating people, because, mm-hmm, as I've said to people before, I'm perfectly happy to go into a building. I'm perfectly happy to drive to an office. But if I'm driving to an office and going into a building, I'm going to spend the day talking to people. I am not going to spend the day on phone calls. I will spend the day physical, not physical, that would be a HR scenario, but, you know, it's kind of, you stood by a whiteboard, sat at a coffee shop, looking at a screen together, pointing at it. Actually, that real, as you call, collaborative working, that you can do there. And I think it's all about using the right tool for the job, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that's what we've got now, is you've got remote, you've got face-to-face, you've got one-to-one, you've got one-to-many, many-to-one, all those different scenarios where it was always default of being in the office. So now we have to think, how am I going to make sure I build relationships with my teams? So I've had now two face-to-faces with my teams, in that I, my team that I've got now in the last trying to do it quarterly. We're all remote. We're all around the country anyway. So we never would have been based in one place. But more heightened now on making sure that all of us, or as many of us as we can, get together in a room for a day and actually work together as a team. And from day one, on the first time we did it, it changed the dynamic on my team. It changed the relationships. It created a group. They had their own independent, purposefully, but they had their own independent areas of management and what they were looking at. Now they're interacting with each other, advising each other, helping each other. And it completely changed. No, and that was just physically, you could see the change from when they actually sat down in a room together and worked together. And one of the nicest things I found that day, first day, was they were all in the room. I'd gone off to do something else, take a couple of calls while they were doing one other part of the work. I came back, I could hear them 20 yards down from the meeting room we're in, laughter coming out of that room, and it was just like the sound of relationships being made. And it was just brilliant. I loved it.
And it's actually really critical for our mental and emotional well-being in the workplace and our sense of belonging.
Yeah.
Which is so critical. And I think one of the challenges for many project managers is, as you say, project teams, and you know, this is certainly my experience in IBM many years ago and still today, is that you form a team really quickly for a specific purpose to run a project. And that project might be short or medium or long term, but you have a very specific set of objectives that you need to meet as a team. How you achieve them has to be worked out, but you have a very clear set of objectives, usually and hopefully, or at least you have to create those.
Yeah.
And then you form really quickly, and then you just have to run, and you get off straight away. So on, you know, minute one, hour one of day one, there you are with the expectation of somehow we will all muddle along together and work our way through our differences of opinion. And I think that's, you know, I think that requires huge leadership skill, huge levels of self-awareness and ability to influence in a way that many other leadership roles don't require at the same level.
Yeah, because you have that innate authority attached to a lot of the other roles, don't you? And that's where it makes it much more difficult to do.
Or you have more stability, I think, if you're in a role that doesn't change, whereas the role of a project manager is, you know, okay, the role and the function of a project manager is the same, but every project is different and every project team is different. And therefore the relationships within the team and therefore the collective team is always going to be different. So there's this continual adapting and flexing to different styles.
Yeah, I get you, see what you're saying. And I suppose it comes to that thing where sort of uncertainty, and I know that's an area that you're focus on with that, and how we lead during uncertainty. My eyesight's getting worse, but I'm sure that's what your book says behind you on your right shoulder.
Leading through uncertainty.
Yeah, and I suppose the thing is we've got a couple of years ago the VUCA kind of phraseology that was around in the project management arena. I'm not sure if it was in all the other management arenas. You can never tell, because sometimes you have your own echo chamber and you think, is that just my echo chamber or is that further around there?
It was everywhere,
and actually the timing of it was quite interesting, really, because through 2019 there was a lot of events, and that's when I first heard that phrase, and I went along to a PMI event in London, and it was all based around VUCA. And then suddenly it was as if someone said, right, look, this is coming in 2020, let's get ready. I don't think we were, well, maybe we were, maybe we weren't, but I wonder whether, if we think about us as humans, why do we find it difficult? Why do we find uncertainty difficult? Because I would have thought it's built in our genes, really, because we grew up on a savannah somewhere. And I know there's many years since then, but you don't know where you're going to get your food from. You don't know whether you're going to get attacked. You don't know whether weather, you're exposed to those sort of things. So living in uncertainty is part of what we do as humans. Mm-hmm. Now, I know obviously society's created more stability now, but why do you think we still find it more, why was it still difficult for us to deal with it?
Because uncertainty threatens our very survival. So if you, as you talk back to caveman times, if there was uncertainty, it was, am I going to get eaten by a tiger or a whatever? Or am I going to find food to eat today?
Yeah.
And that actually, both of those threaten your very existence. And uncertainty creates a threat around, am I safe? Can I survive this threat? And the pandemic was a great example of that, where it was an existential crisis of uncertainty. And there is the existential psychologists have done lots of research into that and said that whenever there is uncertainty, our levels of anxiety will naturally increase. Well, that's certainly what we saw in the pandemic. And so there's this tendency to want to be, and I hear this all the time every day, where people say, it was okay because I was in control there. But as though this idea that we're in control is actually even possible, and that it's the utopia of, if I'm in control, that means everything's okay. Well, if I'm in control, then it's okay for me, but it might not be okay for you.
Yeah.
So, and I think, you know, this is the old style of command and control management of the 70s and 80s, where if I'm in control, then I know everything's okay for me, but the people that work for me have to just go along with what I want. Well, we know that that doesn't work today. Interestingly, when I first wrote the book Leading Through Uncertainty, it was first published in 2018. So a long while before the pandemic. But my initial idea for it was back in 2012. But every time I talked about uncertainty, everybody shut me down and said, no, we like to be in control. Because there was this myth that if we're in control, we're safe. And then if we're in control, I have a plan. And if I have a plan, then everything's going to be fine. Well, project managers will tell you there's a plan and then there's a reality. And there's the rework of the plan and the rework of it, and there's the adaptation. And, you know, those who are used to doing agile working will certainly be familiar with that ability to flex as well. So uncertainty, control is a myth, and uncertainty's always been there, but we've always felt that we're safer if we have control. And you see parents do this with their children, where if they think that they tell their children what to do and their children do what they're told, then their kids are safe. Well, physically they might be, but emotionally they're not, because they're not learning the skills of risk management in their own lives and so on. So uncertainty is healthy as long as we have the skills to navigate it. And I think that's the challenge, because we've had this innate desire to be safe and have control and certainty. And therefore, whenever there is uncertainty, all sorts of things like happen. So our anxiety increases. We have a natural fear response because suddenly our safety is threatened. So whenever there's uncertainty, there is anxiety, there is fear. There's also polarization. So if you look at the pandemic as a great example, or Brexit, or any of the situations where there's uncertainty, you can guarantee that people will have polarized opinions. And that's because if you look at something like the pandemic, we've never led, nobody on the planet has ever led through a global pandemic in a year where we have the technology to work remotely, globally. We've never done that before. And everybody on the planet pretty much had an opinion about how it should be done.
Yeah.
And so what happens is we have opinions that are based on our values, our beliefs, our assumptions, our experience, but they're not fact, because it will be probably decades before we get the facts of what was the best way to run a pandemic. And we may never have the answer, because everybody did it differently. Every country did it differently. And we didn't collaborate globally. We actually went to more an individualistic approach, which again is what often happens in uncertainty, is we move away from collaboration because it's difficult, because we shut down differences of opinion. And so we start to hang on to our own opinion. And it doesn't matter whether you thought, you know, vaccines were great or you thought vaccines were bad. Nobody was ever going to change your mind by sitting down in the pub telling you you were wrong. And the same with Brexit. Nobody ever changed anybody else's mind in the pub saying you should have voted Remain or you should have voted Leave. And yet that's what we try and do. And this is where we create this polarization, because we come from this place of I must be right, which means you must be wrong. And you think the same thing. So this is where we get this clash, or we get a disconnect. And therefore you're not getting that emotional connection, and we're not working through our differences of opinion. And therefore we're shutting down difference and we're shutting down diversity, and we create much more polarization. And we're certainly seeing that in the world today. Yeah. Where it becomes much more vociferous, and social media fuels that, of course.
It's interesting because, and I'm reflecting on my own behaviours through these things, and my I'll admit I'm not a big news consumer. I've avoided the news, the regular news media for 20 years, really. And during the pandemic, I probably watched more news than I have in the 15 years before, 20 years before that. And I found myself, and I've started, when I reflect, that I have kind of shut down on opinions in, or stopped following or removed certain things from my, and I mentioned echo chamber earlier, removed things from mine, which because I didn't, some of it is a case of I just don't agree with some people's points of view. I don't want to have an argument. I don't want to have a conversation with them. Therefore, I've removed them from my, because it's not feeding my mental health. It's not feeding my happiness in life. Mm. But the sacrifice that I make there is somebody else's opinion and me be able to understand someone else's point of view.
Yeah.
But it's a really difficult balance to do it, because again, it's kind of like you'll see a post from certain people that make you absolutely furious, but stop myself getting involved with it, but it still makes me furious and flabbergasted at why someone would say something.
Yeah.
But then it's kind of, do I need to look at and try and understand why they might say that, and where the information they're getting and the point of view of their own personal situation. And it's all, as you say, it's all, we all do things and we behave, whether it be in those big things or in the small thing, based on our own current situation. And the things that I would do in someone else's situation, I may do the same thing and make the same decision as them, or say the same thing as them, if I were in their shoes.
Yeah.
Whereas I can only see it from my shoes. It's hard to balance it. And then when you start looking at stakeholders in your business and stakeholders in the project, people on your team, looking at it, it's easy, and I've done it myself, to knee jerk and think, dickhead, about someone, why are you being like that? And then when I step back and think about it, I think, well, Nigel, you don't know what they're doing at the moment. You don't know what's going on in their team. You don't know what's going on with their manager. But I can't stop myself thinking that way, because I think that's the way my brain will work at times. And it's really difficult, because sometimes you feel guilty about feeling that way. And I suppose the other thing on what you're saying there was around the agile stuff, because agile popped in my head around the uncertainty, because it is the latest buzzword, the latest thing with everything around there. And it introduces uncertainty in a kind of formalized manner. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're, as a project manager, as you say, you can put your project plan together, you know your dev team are going to finish that piece of work in 20 days because they told you they needed 19 days and you added one extra in. So you know they're going to do that work. And you know that the test is going to be able to do it, and you put in several iterations of testing. So you know they're going to sort that all out, and these guys, and you know it because it's on your plan, as you said, and you can go through that and you've got that. I think what it is you understand, if the dev takes longer to develop, you understand why.
Mm-hmm.
In the agile environment, you haven't necessarily got those big markers to put down and go, that's our aim or objective. Because it can be that you haven't got that aim or objective for quite some time. And it can be that fail fast, do it, iterate it through. And that's where I think a lot of our, and I certainly I find it, I love the agile methodologies. I love the ideas and the concepts of them. The actual practical application as a project manager or program manager, portfolio manager, when someone asks you, well, when's it going to be finished? It kind of draws two little things together and they clash with those conversations. And I find it quite challenging to do that because I've got no control. I can't tell someone, oh, I know by definite it's going to be then. All I can say is, well, I know that we'll have a release of something at that point and then a release at that point. And it's quite. Well, I hope you enjoyed that first part of that chat with Jude. Fascinating subject, a fascinating approach to building leadership she has. Come back next week and have a listen to the second part. Cheers. Wow, you made it this far. I'm guessing that you enjoyed the show if you have, or maybe you've just left it playing in the background and forgot it was on. But if you did enjoy it and you're inclined to, I'd be delighted if you could share the show with your colleagues. It's discoverability with podcasts is quite difficult, especially with a niche one like this. But sharing with your colleagues and letting them have a chance to listen to these fantastic guests would be brilliant. If you've got time, a review on whatever platform you listen to it on would be great too, especially if it was a 5-star one. Again, that makes it easier for people to discover the show when they're searching on there, because comments raise it up the old search engine, up some optimization on all the different tools. If you are feeling flush, I have a couple of ways you could contribute. One is Patreon, patreon.com/SundayLunchPM, and you can donate some money to the podcast that way, or you can jump along to my website, nigelcreaser.com, www.nigelcreaser.com, and click on the link to the shop. And in there, you've got all my books that I've created in the varying different guises, a number of different ways you can grab a copy of those. And down the bottom, I've got my guests' books. So everyone who's been on here, if they've had a book, I've got a link to their book in there, and Amazon give me a little bit back for when someone buys from them. But more importantly, if you come back next time and listen, I'll be delighted. So I'll leave you alone and let you get on with your day now. Thank you. Bye. Well, it's goodbye from me, Nigel Creaser, and it's goodbye from him, the Sunday Lunch PM. Goodbye.